Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight's show is going to be epic. We are going to be speaking here. They're going to be speaking here with very, very special guest David Morrell. Of course, you might know David Morrell as being the creator of Rambo with his book First Blood, along with Brotherhood of the Rose. And he has out now a couple fabulous books called Murder is a Fine Art, and coming out very soon is called Inspector of the Dead, which is a sequel to Murder of the Fine Art with the same detective. Same kind of style and everything, and that's something you also have to check out, too. So, the Story Blender, of course, comes to you every other Friday. We have had Robert Dugani and Joe Castillo on, and this is where you will find everything out about the art of storytelling from different points of view, and David is going to be talking about the art of storytelling as he does it in his books and how he kind of perceives how everything kind of comes together. Again, authors, anybody out there, you better be listening, because this is definitely a show you want to be checking out for more research to hear from the masters, see exactly what they have going on. So here you go. But first, we always got some things that we're going to have to tell you. After that's over with, we are going to give you here the Story Blender with author David Morrell. So goodbye, everybody. Tune in. Stay tuned. Show's coming up.
Okay, everybody, here we go. We got some great new stuff for you guys to check out. Author David Lyons is back with his latest book in his Jock Boucher series, Waters of Oblivion. This is the third book in the series, and it could possibly be the best. Here at Suspense Magazine, we call it a must-read, a great espionage thriller, so you need to check out DavidLyonsAuthor.com for a lot more information on this book and the rest of the series. Midnight Ink is celebrating 10 years of great mystery suspense books, and we are always excited to receive a new Midnight Ink book, just because we always know it's of the very highest quality with fabulous authors. Make sure that you visit midnightinkbooks.com and discover some of those fabulous new authors to place on your shelf. Would you become a serial killer to save your child? Because that's one of the questions author Mike Pace asks in his latest book, One to Go. Steve Barry says terrific, ripping good, explosive excitement, says Douglas Preston, and relentlessly suspenseful, says John Land. So you need to visit MikePaceBooks.com for more information on that. Also, new from author Jamie Mason is Monday's Lie. Jamie placed her name solidly in the suspense genre with her last book, Three Graves, and Monday's Lie should appeal to fans of The Americans and Homeland. So do yourself a favor, check out Monday's Lie and visit Jamie on her website at jamie-mason.com. Don't forget the hyphen. Now, when Brad Thor calls your book awesome and one of the hottest authors in the thriller genre, you definitely need to start taking notice. And from Kensington Press is author Mark Cameron with his latest book, Day Zero. Also, Candace Fox brings horror abound in her latest book, Hades. So visit KensingtonBooks.com for a lot more on all of their titles. To catch a satanic killer, Detective Jennifer Mueller will go into the Devil's Reach. And that's the title of author Lewis Weinberg's latest book. It's graphic, gritty, wildly entertaining are just some of the words that are being used to describe this latest thriller. So make sure you go to Lewis Weinberger, WEINBERGER.com, for a lot more information on everything he's got going on. And just remember, we want to tell everyone to make sure that you check out all of our sponsors by visiting, too, suspensemagazine.com. You can get the magazine, see what all we have going inside. And thanks for all the support that you all guys do, because without you, we wouldn't have this radio show and these magazines, and we wouldn't be able to bring this fine stuff to you. So, again, we want to thank all of you guys out there for listening, and enjoy the show. And enjoy.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James.
And I'm Jose Castillo.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. And we are thrilled today because we have an international bestselling author, David Morrell, is joining us today. He has written many novels, including First Blood, which introduced the world to Rambo. David has a PhD in American literature and chooses to write thrillers for a living, which I think is just fantastic. His 30 books have been translated into more than 24 languages and sold more than 20 million copies. He's also known for taking his research seriously and studying hostage negotiation, outdoor wilderness survival, and executive protection. So if we're traveling anywhere, this is the guy to be with. And Dean Koontz has called him an absolute master of the thriller. And David, thanks for joining us today.
Well, and thank you for having me.
We got to get to the first thing right off the bat. This PhD in American literature, and you write action novels and thrillers. That's fantastic.
Well, it's I sometimes think of myself, without trying to compare, I have a great fondness for the jazz musician Oscar Peterson, and he a great pianist, and I met him once, and he reminded me as we talked that he was trained as a concert pianist, and then switched over to jazz, which makes him very unusual in the jazz format. And I got to thinking that maybe I'm a little bit like him in the thriller format, because most of the authors I know in writing thrillers are, I mean, they're educated, but they haven't had that rigorous training that, say, a Peterson had or I had, you know, in graduate school. And so I think that while some authors are almost entirely intuitive when they work, I'm much more on the other side and very aware of the effects that I want to achieve and the kinds of techniques available to me in order to make that happen.
Now, do you outline your books? Because you said some are intuitive. Do you tend to go, I know people go different directions. I'm not an outliner myself, but I know some people are very meticulous about that. Others like to see the story unfold as they go ahead with it.
You know, the most extreme outliner I know is Jeffrey Deaver, who starts with a paragraph as a kind of concept and then expands it into two paragraphs to sort of see if there's a little bit more there, and then starts to work toward an outline and then amplifies the outline and amplifies it until he has written the novel. it's the most unusual way I know of writing, and when I meant intuitive, that, you know, some writers are intuitive. They, you know, they get into a scene and they sort of know what works, but they're not quite sure why. In my case, in terms of outlines, I have a technique that I call a written conversation with myself, and I have a writing book called The Successful Novelist. And it has a subtitle which sort of says everything, a lifetime of lessons about writing and publishing, because this is my 42nd year doing this, and there aren't a whole lot of us, you know, who've been around that long. And what I learned over the years was to, if I had an idea for a book or something in my daydreams, which is a lot of my stuff comes from, that I, you know, really thought, it was grabbing me so much that I wanted to write about it, I would write a letter to myself, or what I sometimes called self-psychoanalytic prose, in which I talked to myself on the page, asking myself why I thought the idea was interesting and what there was in it that was worth, and this is key for me, spending a year of my life on a project, and sometimes more. We'll probably talk about Murder as a Fine Art eventually, and that's a 3-year book, 2 years of research. And, I mean, you really have to be committed to an idea to go that long with it. And so I like to say that all we have of importance is time. And so when I start a project, I have to convince myself that it's worth a year of my life. And I have certain necessary points. One is that the theme has to be something that I think is important to me personally that I want to communicate. And then there has to be something about the way the story is told that's different. I don't repeat myself by and large, and something that's different enough that other writers might pay attention. And then finally, that there's something about the research, and you mentioned that earlier, how important it is to me, something about the research which will make me fuller, that I'll learn something that I didn't have before that I can add to myself. Probably the most extreme case there was I was writing a book about the Marfa lights in West Texas, a book called The Shimmer, and airplanes have been used to chase those lights, not succeeding, but I knew I needed airplane sequences, and I don't like to write about stuff I don't know about, so I took some flying classes, and the next thing I knew after a while, I had my pilot's license.
That's just fantastic. I love it.
I know some people don't like to do research. I don't understand that. The research is what adds the truth to what we're doing. So anyway, I put all this into a letter to myself, which might run maybe 20 or 30 single-space pages. There's a couple of advantages to it. One is that I'm not talking the story out, say, with my wife or a friend or my editor or my agent, and, sort of losing the thrust, the sort of into the ozone. Hemingway had a big suspicion about talking about ideas, but that I'm actually writing it down, and that I then have a permanent record of my thought processes, so that if I get sick, God forbid, or some other terrible thing happens, or I get distracted, that I can come back, even a year later and look at the document and get right back up to speed the day as if it were the day I was writing it. So there are a lot of advantages, and I have a chapter about it in the writing book, and other writers have told me they found it to be very useful.
Yeah, and that you hit on one of the points I wanted to talk about, which is, we have method actors. Do we have method writers? I know you've been trained in firearms and hostage negotiation, assuming identities, all those fun things, and even to the becoming a private pilot. Is that something that is critical to your storytelling success, becoming that method writer?
It is, yes. And it's funny that you should mention that, because I've often called myself that, the equivalent of a method actor. I need to get into the role. I need to enter the world. So, I interview people who do the stuff that I'm writing about, and ideally it's something I don't know about so that I'm learning. As I said, I want it to add to me as a person. And, I next to learning how to fly a plane, the most fun I had was learning how to car fight. I went to a racetrack in West Virginia where they taught a lot of government people how to handle themselves in roadblocks and stuff like that. And so for 5 days at 50 miles an hour, I was learning how to car fight. It was just absolutely, it was just a hoot, doing all the spins and all that and ramming barricades. And we had to be in the car that was attacked, and then we'd be in the car that was doing the attacking. And it was just a lot of fun. You get in that world, and the big problem, of course, with research is when to stop, when it's with the story. I think over the years I've learned that, you have the story, and then all this is nice, but what details are really going to be the core ones that, make people believe in what's happening? And now with Murder is a Fine Art, the recent book, which is a Victorian mystery thriller, it's set in 1854 London, and, when I started that, I said, wow, here I am a contemporary American thriller writer, wanting to go across the ocean and back in time more than 150 years, and I knew that readers would be lying in wait, to find fault. So I said, well, I think I'm going to have to get what amounts to a self-educated PhD in Victorian London of the 1850s. And so for 2 years, I can't tell you how obsessed I was with that world. I just loved it. And for 2 years, literally, all I read were books related to the period, either histories or cultural studies or else fiction from the period or biographies about people from the period. And I have a big map in my office of 1851 London, and I'm able to get around 1851 London pretty damn good, you know, as if it's real in my mind.
Put on the top hat and hire the handsome cab, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, you know, and you know, the different kinds of cabs and all that, and you may be familiar with Richard Matheson's Bid Time Return, which was made into a film called Somewhere in Time, or the Jack Finney novel Time and Again, in which the main characters concentrate so hard on a moment in the past that they're transported back there. And that's what happened to me for that period when I was writing the book. I mean, it got a little weird. I truly believe that I was there. And then readers have said, in fact, I had a note next to my keyboard which said, try to make readers believe they are literally in 1854 London. And again, that's the research. What telling detail? How much did a woman's clothes weigh in 1854, for example? The answer is 37 pounds. And to find those details, and people say, "Gee, I didn't know that." And then you have the reader. You've captured. You've achieved your purpose.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I know we've talked to other people, and it kind of keeps coming up, this idea of not getting in the way of your reader, and for you it even goes another step, and that is not only create it believable, but where it's so believable that it's almost as if they're experiencing it right there when they're reading the book.
Yes, and now mind you, apart from research, you know, we get down to some nuts and bolts here. Apart from research, the most efficient way to convince a reader that the reader is in the story is to take the senses sight for granted and emphasize the other senses. To a degree that a story is sight-dominated, it will feel one-dimensional. And I'm most happy when I'm writing scenes at night or in dark rooms or things like that, because I can take sight for granted and emphasize particularly smell. Smell is the most intimate of our senses. And if you can triangulate that, it's a term I picked up in grad school when I was doing my doctorate on the works of John Barth, and he talked about this, the theory of triangulation in description, in which you would take the sense of sight for granted and triangulate it with two other senses, touch and and sound, for example, although touch and sound are very similar. And to that degree, that you do it subtly so you don't tip your hand, to that degree the reader will feel enveloped in the scene. And I use those two words really deliberately, feel enveloped in the scene. And that's all done with, you know, sensory cues. I've told this to many, many, many writers, and it's amazing how they say, gee, yeah, I understand, and then they think it's on the page, but it's still sight-dominated because they haven't put in the cues. The cues were in their head, not on the page.
Yeah, I was thinking of your book Creepers, and it takes place in New York City, kind of in, I would say kind of abandoned buildings and sewers and all the places you're not supposed to go, the urban explorers.
Yeah, places you're not supposed to be. It's actually an abandoned hotel in Asbury Park, New Jersey, which used to be like Bosnia during the war years of the 90s, and then, you know, it's better now, but when I was writing that book in 2004 and 5, it was really a terrible place. And so these urban explorers, you know, who are history and architecture enthusiasts, go into this old building that's been boarded up since the 50s, but dates back to the 1901. And it's mostly dark. They have flashlights.
Yeah.
And I just had a wonderful time writing a book. In fact, that's one of the book did very well for me, but sometimes, you know, the ones you like take longer. But I was able to write that book, I remember, at lightning speed in 4 months. It was amazing how the pages were coming out, because I think in part because I was so happy writing about darkness. we'll all go hang ourselves. No, but not, you know, being in the dark, you know, and shadows and what was over there and what do I hear and what do I smell. That's really, you know, how we hypnotize readers.
Yeah, that's good. I was thinking of when you write, you want, it sounds like from what you're saying, you really want the readers to experience something. It isn't just, you know, it isn't just you know, reading words on a page or something, but it's really transporting them to wherever it is, whether it's this hotel or back into the 1850s. What are some of the tools that you use besides research to really transport readers and help them experience on an emotional, a deep level, the stories that you're trying to tell?
Well, the two authors who most influenced me in this regard were Ernest Hemingway, who's most known for his, you know, for the early taut, you know, tight style, but he's also known for his use of concrete words. And I did my master's thesis on Hemingway's style. And while I don't write like Hemingway in terms of his rhythms and his sentence structure, I learned an awful lot about him, style from him with regard to, I'll just give you one example, The Boy Walked Up the Hill. Now, in your minds, you saw a boy walking up a hill. I didn't need to describe it. And if I get into sight, you may have added a tree at the top of the hill. And if the tree isn't important to the story, I don't care whether you have this tree in your mind or not. What I'm interested in when I write that scene isn't what the hill looks like. It's what the is it the fall, for example? Is it autumn? Is there a wind? Is the wind cold? Has the wind frozen the grass upon which he walks, in which case there'll be a sound of his footsteps? And so I get into, you know, that sort of thing, and it really goes back to Hemingway and the use almost exclusively of concrete words. And the other author then who sort of helped me to capitalize on this was James M. Cain, whose The Postman Always Rings Twice and Double Indemnity are, you know, just two must-read books for any author because the technique is so transparent. And you just say, oh, my God, how can he write so simply and effectively? And Cain had a theory about sequence, that if you put certain details in a certain sequence, you would, almost like a physics experiment, have a predictable result. And so if you put these two things together, that's basically, you know, what the principles that I abide by. When I start a scene, I say, all right, what is the purpose of the scene? Why is this scene here? Where am I going with it? All right, so what are the necessary ingredients for me to build the scene so that I achieve the purpose I want? And if it's a pretty good scene, it'll in fact have two or three purposes. But I'm going to focus on one, you know, maybe characterization or what have you. But in terms of the plot, you know, what information here is absolutely necessary for the reader to move on? And Cain talked about this in terms of what he called the algebra of storytelling, that if you put the proper detail followed by the proper detail by the next proper detail, that the reader would be carried along inevitably. So that, you know, these are simple and yet very, very complicated ideas. But when I married these two guys in my head, Hemingway and Cain, and their ideas, it made a big difference for me.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, that's excellent. I have to ask this now. This is my big burning question.
Yeah.
In 1982, I was a little kid in Knoxville, Tennessee, and
right.
I was head-to-toe camouflage, and the only thing I wanted in the world was a Rambo survival knife.
Absolutely.
I was not able to go see the movie, but my dad somehow got me a Rambo survival knife. I have no idea how my mom let him give that to me.
I'm wondering myself.
But it was my most prized possession, and while I wasn't able to see the movie for many years after that, the stories that came with me, you know, through that survival knife were such a powerful thing for me as a kid at that age. Was that
great
something
story.
That when you stepped into First Blood, were you looking for objects like that were almost characters themselves?
No, not really. And in fact, the knife becomes important in the movie more than in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I give credit to Sylvester for Richard Crenna once told me that he thought in his long career there were only two actors he'd worked with who knew what to do in front of a camera. They might not be the greatest emotive actors, but when they're in front of a camera, they knew how to make the camera like them. And those two actors were Steve McQueen and Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah, interesting.
You know, and Stallone, you know, is just brilliant with his eyes and the way he, you know, he uses props in order to communicate character. But before I forget, there's a movie called Son of Rambo, and it's spelled R-A-M-B-O-W. It's a spelling. It's British, and it's a coming-of-age story in Britain in the mid-1980s in which two boys, 12 years old, I just sparked on this when you said that story, two kids around 12 years old, terrible home lives, escape into the Rambo movies to get something that they're not getting elsewhere, and they dress up like Rambo and Troutman, and they make whole movies as if they're Rambo. And for some, this is a very, very small budget. It's a charming film, but very small budget. And I don't understand how it happened that the producers were able to Son of Rambo, were able to persuade the Rambo people, the real Rambo people, to let them use many, many, many scenes from the original films.
Huh, interesting.
Wow. So that these kids are, watching in the theater, or else it's in their head and they're trying to do it the way the actors did it. And it's pretty cool. So if you're not familiar with it, you might have a little flashback to the way you were. Yeah, 1982, that's when the debut novel, First Blood, sometimes called Rambo First Blood because of the way the films have been remembered, was published in 72, and then the movie came out in 82. And, it was a very lucky book for me. It's never been out of print. This is its 42nd year, and it's still flying along. Next year, Gauntlet Press is going to do a big special edition, and I went through my files and found the original first chapter, which is different from the published chapter.
Oh, that's fun.
And an outline for it and all kinds of deleted scenes and all that we're going to put into this special collection. It was
amazing.
Sort of, it was weird going back to 72 and reading all this stuff that I didn't remember. I know I wrote them, but...
what was it about that character, John Rambo, that resonated so much with popular culture at that time, but even today?
It's part of it has to do with the way it was located in 72 in the midst of the Vietnam War. We must always remember that Rambo is a Vietnam veteran. He came back. He had been a prisoner of war. He was radicalized by the war. The key to the book, to my character as opposed to the movie characters, is that he came back and discovered that the one thing he was good at was killing people, and he hated himself for it. And he didn't know how to rectify this within himself. The model for the character was Audie Murphy, the most decorated American soldier of World War II, whose Medal of Honor citation reads a lot like what you would expect Rambo to have done. Murphy held off like 250 enemy soldiers. This was in Europe. While he was shooting from a burning half track with a 50 caliber machine gun mounted, and also trying to assist a wounded a member of his team. And then when it finally got too hot, he threw the guy over his shoulder and backed up firing at these guys.
That's crazy.
And, joined his team. And, it went on from there. It was an astonishingly heroic, and Murphy was just a little guy. But when he got back to civilization, shall we call it, he had basically a breakdown. And he had what we think of as PTSD and woke up screaming. He carried a gun, and at night when he had nightmares, he fired it. And he was once arrested for pistol whipping a guy, a dog trainer whom he claimed had cheated somebody about the price of training the dog. And Murphy was very, very troubled. And I thought, I can use this guy. And I think the novel went into the angst of that whole terrible period in which basically I thought there was going to be a civil war in the United States because of the Vietnam War. And then, basically the novel is a mini civil war. It's the Vietnam War coming home and the consequences. And, you know, there's a line in the movie, it's not in the book, but it might as well have been, you know, leave me alone or I'll give you a war you'll never forget. Mm-hmm. And so that was my intent. And what floats past people, although I've talked about it a lot, is that Colonel Troutman's first name is Sam. He's Sam Troutman. And I saw the whole novel as an allegory in that Sam Troutman was Uncle Sam, that he was the system, that he had created this man, and that, you know, then what do you do with him? And that, you know, the whole problem, and we're seeing this now with returned soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, okay, they did their work, they did what they were trained for, and then they're in many cases discarded. There isn't the loyalty to them after the fact. And so I think that there's a lot of truth in the emotion in the book and in parts of the movies that people recognize, and that, you know, it's part of, you know, what do we do with people who discover they're good at killing?
Yeah, that's good. You know, what you said really struck me, and that is that the truth of the story resonates with people, even though obviously it's a fictionalized account, a fictionalized story. But one of the things that we seem to keep coming up with is this idea that people want to hear the truths about life. They want to dive in deeply. Readers want to, or people watching a film, want to experience these deep emotional truths of life. And that's one of the things I like about your books, is they're actually action books and thrillers and so on, but there's more dimensions, more levels to them.
Well, you're hitting upon something that when I teach, I go around to writers' groups and sometimes to colleges and, you know, do daily workshops and things like that. And I go back to the goal I had when I was writing First Blood and all of the books, but, you know, since we were talking about First Blood, and it became so well known, is what my goal was. And, you know, I had learned from Hemingway that there was a way to write action that didn't feel pulpy, that didn't feel like it came out of old magazines, and that it didn't feel, you know, genre-like and what have you. And so my goal was, and I've tried to do this, I've written espionage novels, and I've written horror, and now I'm writing, you know, as I said, Victorian historical thrillers. But the goal, no matter the genre, is to write them so that they don't feel like a genre book. Some of our colleagues, pursue, I think, sometimes stay too much within the lines, and that there is a way to look long and hard at a situation and to say, all right, you know, we have all this excitement and the chases and the bullets are flying, but if this were real, what would these characters feel and what would they think? I mean, there have been days. I'm working on the third and probably final Victorian thriller, there have been days when I've written a scene that I felt good about. I thought, this is great, and I've come back the next morning and I said, yeah, but have I seen this before? You know, what really, let's pretend I really am in 1854 London, and what would I be thinking? And it's amazing what you can find in this, and this goes back to that method acting, method writing concept. It's amazing what you can find in a scene that, you know, in effect, the story is telling me what it wants rather than the other way around. But the goal would be, you know, just to back off a little, the goal would be, since we're writing genre books, and, you know, someone once asked Stephen King why he writes horror, and he said, what makes you think I have a choice? And it's the same thing with me writing thrillers. I had a terrible, terrible childhood. I was put in an orphanage, and nobody explained what I was doing there, and I ran with gangs, and my mother had to put me in an orphanage, and later my father had died in combat, and later she remarried, but the guy she married didn't like kids, and there was fighting all the time, and I slept under the bed afraid for myself. I lived in fear for most of my young years, and I told stories to myself in the dark under the bed. And usually I was the hero and I was saving people. And, you know, it's not hard to see the mechanism there. But, you know, when I grew up, it's as if I was programmed to be a thriller writer. And then, you know, add the other fact that I had this doctorate in American Lit, so that I was looking at thrillers in just a different way, maybe than is usual, and that, you know, this would, you know, first of all, I'm predetermined, I guess you could say, to be a thriller writer. But then, you know, what do I do with that, you know? And the result was to, you know, try to write thrillers that didn't feel like thrillers, so to speak. You know, it didn't feel like genre books.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do end up doing kind of cookie-cutter books that get into a genre, whether it's romance or mystery or thrillers and so on. And you can pick up just about every one of their books, and it's the same story. They just change the love interest name and the
yeah.
antagonist's name, and there's a different serial killer or whatever it is. And,
what that goes back to, I mean, it's 42 years, which is, I mentioned how long I've been doing this, and, you know, I'm still going strong. You know, what causes careers to end? The average career of a successful writer, and I've seen this, I've lived through it, I've seen it, is 15 to 20 years. Because now some go longer. You know, my friend Lawrence Block, you know, has been going on much longer than I have, and I think of F. Paul Wilson and a couple of other folks that I know, Joe Lansdale, that, you know, they've been around as long as I have. I sometimes think that what happens is that some writers find something early in their career that works, and they don't want to let it go. So they work it, and they work it, and they work it, and they work it. And, you know, if you write 15 books that are the same, it's very hard, unless you're Ken Follett, as he did. And I won't, you know, Follett's books were of a different order, so I don't even want to suggest he was imitating himself. But it takes really a brass personality to do what Follett did and suddenly begin writing about the Middle Ages. So what happens is some writers just say, well, that's what I do, and then readers get tired along about the 15th book. There are exceptions, and the writer gets tired. And my goal was, with each decade, it turned out this way. I wasn't thinking of it so much in the decade, but I wanted to keep evolving. I wanted to keep myself interested, again, on the basis that all I have is time. It's all that's important. And so if I could write and keep myself interested by finding new ways to do this, I had to laugh. My friend Steve Barry, I had dinner with him a couple of years ago, and he said, well, what are you working on? I said, well, I'm writing about this very fascinating real-life guy named Thomas DeQuincey. He was the first guy to write about drug addiction in a book called Confessions of an English Opium Eater, and I've made him the main character. I've made him the main character of this Victorian mystery thriller. And Steve looked at me aghast for a little bit, and finally he said, you son of a bitch, you reinvented yourself again. and it's true, I had, you know, and I probably do it one more time still, because, you know, I think maybe three of Victorian mystery thrillers are enough. what else the world has got, you know, in wait for me?
See, that's the true heart of a storyteller, is instead of getting caught up in one thing or telling the same stories or getting caught in the same pattern over and over, it's to continue to explore. And I know for me, I always have to try, it's kind of, you know, once in a while, just try something completely different, just to see, you know, what it's like. And part of the creative process is always stepping off the cliff, trying something
exactly,
else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And mind you, it's scary.
Yeah.
I mean, it's terrifying. I had several author friends of mine tell me about Murder as a Fine Art that I was committing career suicide, that no one would follow me to 1854 London. But, you know, I was just so in love with Thomas DeQuincey, and so, you know, I just wanted so badly. What had happened is my granddaughter had died, and I just hated the world, and I wanted to get away from everything that was around me. And, you know, in my mind, I was just wanting to escape to 1854, which wouldn't be a place you want to live in. But it really, you know, it was like going to Mars. So, you know, back I went and lived there, and I, you know, in my mind, and it, you know, the therapy worked. But, you know, God knows there were people, other authors who thought, I don't know, man, that's not maybe the coolest idea. And as you know, you need a great support group. You need, you know, your friends and you know, your if you're living with somebody, their support, and you need the support of your agent and your editor. And sometimes that isn't there. Sometimes people will say, gee, you know, I don't, maybe the next book. and I have, I can't mention names, but there, and none of them I have mentioned so far, but there are people of immense stature I've spoken to who told me that they wanted to do a book on this subject or that subject, which wasn't really what they were known for, and that the, you know, the publisher just went nuts and said, no, this is what we can sell. We don't want that other stuff. So it does take a certain, you know, bravery, for lack of a better word, to say, well, okay, I'll face the cliff and see what happens. And God knows it cannot work. You know, it won't work. And then what do you do? So, you know, what we do is not easy. You know, the daily doubt, the daily questioning of, you know, is this stuff any good, or is, you know, what I'm working on that's going to take 6 months or a year, is it something that people would want to read about? You know, I'm not sure that what I call civilians, you know, understand the stress of being a professional storyteller.
But I do like that readers respond well to people who are telling honest stories about, it doesn't have to be about themselves, but about the life situations that they're in and that coming out and what they're writing. And I think people respond to that so much better than the, you know, sort of the machine of, well, here's what I've done before, so I'm going to keep that going.
Well, I did a Western once. I admired the Wild Bunch so much that I thought, I want to see what I can do in 1916 Mexico. Against the background of the Spanish or the Mexican Civil War, one of the civil wars, and you know, it's a book I'm immensely proud of. It's called Last Reveille, and it's about the last cavalry charges in the U.S. Army. And but you know, that is one of my least read books because Westerns aren't hot right now. But do I care? I mean, yeah, I suppose I do, in the sense that it would have been nice for people to, you know, say, oh, buy it, you know, in hundreds of thousands. But I never regretted writing the book. I mean, that would have just eaten at me if I didn't do it. You know, it's something I'm very proud of. But I'm not sure readers will always follow you. One of the things I discovered in this very long career is that readers say they're loyal to an author, but they're really loyal to a type of book that the author writes.
Interesting.
Now, I don't want to seem contradictory. You know, I could have sold a whole lot more books early in my career, and, you know, for the first half of the career, if I had done nothing but write more of Rambo or of The Brotherhood of the Rose, which is another book that I'm very well known for. An espionage novel that combined in 1984, that combined the American and the British spy novel traditions. It was the first one to do that. And I could have gone on forever doing that until the 1990s, so forever is a short time. the bottom fell out of the thriller market in the 1990s, the international thriller market. I mean, there were still, you know, some kinds of thrillers, but the spy novel, you would have had a terrible time persuading a publisher to publish a spy novel in the 1990s, because the USSR dissolved, and basically that East-West conflict, which was so integral to those spy novels, went away. In fact, I co-edited a book called Thrillers 100 Must Reads with my friend Hank Wagner. And at the end, Steve Barry has a very interesting essay about the collapse of the thriller market in the 1990s. To back up, because I think I'm still on topic, on the one hand, I'm saying that, you know, as writers, we have to evolve, and you won't have the long career. But in the short term, If you are discouraged by peaks and valleys, you know, a certain kind of writer will just say, well, I write this kind of book, and this is what readers want from me. And they probably do just want that from that writer. That, you know, the writer will just stick on that kind of thing and not have the long career. So it's a trade-off. Do you want a long career, or do you want an intense 10, 15 years? You know, so everything's a gamble.
Yeah, no, but passion, this comes through in what you're saying. Passion of telling, you know, a unique story, a great story. Passion that goes behind the research. You know, some novelists will pump out 2, 3, 4 books a year.
Yeah.
And I honestly have no idea how they do that.
I don't get it either.
You know, I mean, because, you know, a year is hard enough for me to pull off.
This isn't a joke, all right? I thought the guy was joking, but he wasn't. You know, when the e-book, you know, phenomenon erupted, what I called the gold rush in 2009, and then went away. You know, e-books only grew at 6% last year. Compared to, you know, exponential growth in 2010, 2011, and 2012. You had people that thought they were going to, as had happened in 2009 with the early adapters, were going to make, you know, some millions of copies. And, you know, hardly anybody does that anymore. Some do, you know, still at 99 cents and what have you. But there was this, I met this person, I won't say who, and the guy said to me, I just didn't sell those. The book didn't do as well as I thought. So, you know, the only way I can get the money I need is by writing a book a month.
Phew.
And, you know, and he wasn't kidding.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought, all right, you know, go ahead, automatic writing. But, you know, I believe surely people, you know, surely readers can tell when the stuff hasn't even been reread.
I know. It's,
you know?
Yeah. It's this weird new model where they write, you know, 7 or more books a year, like what you just said, a book a month, and then they start giving them away or selling for 99 cents, and, you know, it floods the market with stuff that isn't good. I mean,
well,
it's not worth the time.
And people, readers have wised up to that.
Yeah.
I mean, we're seeing the end of a certain wave. And, you know, whatever will come next, I think it might be audiobooks. I was reading about audiobooks that are only audiobooks with music and, you know, like audio plays. There was a piece in the New York Times. Jeffrey Devers just released a book that, runs 4 hours, I guess, and it's only an audiobook. And audiobooks last year rose by 28%. E-books rose by 6%, and Lord help us, because I'm just addicted. I just love printed books. Printed books were 2% less. But I think this is all going to work out, and, you know, some of that is just that people don't want to spend, you know, even a discount, $16.95 for a hardback,
right.
And, you know, they'd sooner buy the e-book. You know, it all depends on what you're doing with the books. That's sort of interesting to me that audiobooks are making such a big gain.
That is interesting.
And
yeah.
It's not like a red book. It's not like Dick Estelle on, you know, on public broadcasting. You know, when he used to read, maybe he still does, when he used to, you know, read a book like The Fireside Chat. No, these are like plays.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with music and sound effects and all that, harkening back to the way radio was in the 30s and the 40s.
Right.
Well, this is fantastic. So as we close up, I know you've taught, you know, writing all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
What would you like maybe aspiring authors to really know, maybe one closing word of advice for
sure.
them as they try to shape and tell their stories?
It's easy, and it's a mantra that I tell every time. Be a first-rate version of yourself and not a second-rate version of another author.
Nice.
Everybody is unique. And, you know, when I was being trained, you know, if you think of Hemingway and Faulkner and Edith Wharton and John Steinbeck, there are no substitutes. They are unique. They're 100% themselves. And the authors we admire, you know, that we, you know, we come home from doing something and say, oh, good, I'm going to read tonight, I'm going to read this writer, are usually writers who are one of a kind. And so nobody wants to, you know, I don't think anyhow. I mean, I believe that if you read my stuff, you could say, you know, nobody else is writing quite like this, you know, because the forces that made me what I am, nobody else had working upon them. And same with you guys. So, you know, if we are true to ourselves and we write books that only we can write, at least we'll be satisfied. I can't guarantee we'll be stars, but we'll be satisfied because we did what we were intended to do. And then, you know, if we're good enough and the stories are interesting enough, people will say, yeah, I want to read that stuff, as opposed to imitating. And, you know, who wants to read imitation? You know, the trend ends, and there you are, and you wasted the year writing something you didn't believe in the first place. So I'll just say it again. Be a first-rate version of yourself and not a second-rate version of another writer.
That's amazing.
That's
excellent,
fantastic,
advice.
Yeah.
And of course, you can find out more about David Morrell. Go to davidmorrell.net, and you can also find his book, Murder as a Fine Art. And then you said you've also got one coming out next year. That's correct?
Well, here we are talking about Don't Imitate Yourself, and I've got a sequel coming out. what it is, it's called Inspector of the Dead. And you know, the basic thing is I had so much more to say about Thomas De Quincey. I mean, here we have an opium addict whom I'm using as a detective. And he was an expert in murder. That's what he, one of his avocations. He was just fascinated by murderers, and he believed that murder could be a fine art if it evoked pity and terror. And so I, you know, in the first book, Murder is a Fine Art, I explored that, and we got to like him. But in the second book, Inspector of the Dead, we're learning more about the cost of what it means to be an opium addict. So I wanted to do these three books in which the cost of what made him brilliant is is explored. So it's quite a ride, and you know, also I'm still getting to live in 1854 London, but I won't be there forever. I mean, it's just against all my judgment not to do a long series, but it struck me that a trilogy was worthy of the subject matter. Anyway,
David, thanks for your time. Thanks for being here. Thanks to all of our listeners. For more about our guests and to check out our other broadcasts, click to thestoryblender.com. Next time, we'll be meeting with comedian and author Bob Stromberg.
And, of course, as we always like to say here at The Story Blender, the art of the story is all in the blend.
See you next time.